I want to tell you about a remarkable report commissioned and endorsed by the President of the United States. It mobilized hundreds of leading social scientists to examine private American life. Quote, "To help all of us see where social stresses are occurring and where major efforts should be undertaken to deal with them constructively," unquote. The resulting document has one recurring theme. The American family is in irreversible institutional decline. As the experts summarize, the factory has displaced the family as the chief unit of economic production. Meanwhile, most educational and protective functions of the family have also been transferred to the state or industry. Commonly forgotten was how, in agrarian times, the family had served as the chief economic, schooling, and security institution of society. In short, the home had been a factory. In marriages, men and women sought not only a mate and companion, but a business partner. Children were not only objects of affection, but also productive agents. In this time, however, the average household produces almost nothing of value, while the teaching function has shifted to schools. Even the old practice of family prayer has now largely been abandoned, while recreation has also moved outside the family circle. According to the experts, all that is left are the personality functions of the family, whereby each family member adapts him or herself to the outside world. The scholars affirm the popular judgment that, quote, "some homes are merely parking places for parents and children who spend their active hours elsewhere," unquote. The research committee emphasizes new Census Bureau reports showing both marriages and children to be diminishing in number. Within functionless homes, children are increasingly individualized. That's the word that appears throughout this report, individualized, meaning that a child is now regarded more as an individual and less as a bearer of the family name. Fathers have largely shed their role as head of the family and arbiter of intra-family disputes. Women, meanwhile, face an ongoing crisis of identity, having abandoned pre-industrial tasks such as sewing, food preservation, and cooking, and with ever fewer, if any, babies, women turn aggressively and inevitably to outside occupations. The report continues, "Since Americans no longer make things in their homes, the efforts of family members are focused instead on," quote, "buying a living," unquote. Consumer goods proliferate, and new advertising practices represent commercial stimulation on the greatest scale yet attempted in human history. Here again, family bonds unravel as new ideas, quote, "as to the equality of marriage partners and in parent-child relations, individualize the purchase of goods and services throughout the household." In this social order, parents also and inevitably surrender their authority over children. As the presidential report summarizes, the government is assuming a larger protective role with its policing forces, its enormously expanded schools, its courts, and its social legislation. Unquote. More specifically, compulsory education laws represent an assumption of family functions by government agencies. While the public school teacher, and again this is a direct quote, "the public school teacher may be viewed as a substitute parent in regard to the function of training the child. Such teachers are reaching into the home ever earlier and so taking the child at a younger age." Unquote. Meanwhile, as homes and families fail in meeting responsibilities other social welfare agencies necessarily move in as, quote, equivalent to the task of social reconstruction. Ponder that phrase, social reconstruction, to be pursued by state authorities. Which president is responsible for this monstrous, almost totalitarian report? Might it be Barack Obama, as an adjunct to his advocacy for abortion rights, same-sex marriage, and mandatory public education? Or might it be Hillary Clinton, a product of her co-presidency during the 1990s, when she surely shaped the social policy of her husband's administration? No. In fact, this project was the brainchild of Republican President Herbert Hoover, inaugurated the same year as he was, that is 1929, and published in early 1933, just as he left office, in a two-volume, 1,568-page report. Entitled Recent Social Trends. The family, it appears, has been a social political problem much longer than usually assumed, with some unexpected twists and turns. Well, let us now move 90 years forward and draw some questions from the arguments of the Hoover Report to illuminate our session today on the centrality of the family. Is family decline the inevitable result of the capitalist urban industrial revolution? Is individualization in all aspects of life also the inevitable consequence of this revolution? Should feminism be understood as but another, albeit powerful, expression of this individualization impulse? Is Hoover's concept of individualization the parent, so to speak, of contemporary ideas such as self-actualization, gender theory, and transgenderism? However, if we are not trapped in social economic determinism here, what role might public policy play in sheltering or encouraging conventional marriage, the birth of children, and autonomous homes? Should tax policy, for example, favor families? What about birth bonuses? What about tougher divorce laws? How might education policy strengthen families? Is the Republican Party still aligned in practice with individualized and industrialized worldviews found in the Hoover Report? Put another way, putting sloganeering aside, can the Republican Party ever be a reliable and effective pro-family party? What about the Democrats? Any signs of hope within the democracy in 2022? And what role might religion, specifically religious communitarianism, play in nurturing and sheltering family renewal in our time? For possible answers on these and related questions, I turn now to our speaker and respondents, and I will introduce all three at the same time here. Our speaker today is Professor Scott Yanor, teaches political science at Boise State University, and is a Washington Fellow at the Claremont Institute's Center for the American Way of Life. He's the author of several important books on family questions, including most recently The Recovery of Family Life, Exposing the Limits in Modern Ideologies from Baylor Press, which is now out in paperback. I had the opportunity some years ago to review his earlier book, For Modern Age. The book was entitled Family Politics, The Idea of Marriage in Modern Political Thought. And would note that I was particularly impressed by the depth and originality of his historical analysis there. I recommend the book. He earned his PhD from Loyola University in Chicago and his BA from the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, in the great Middle West. He lives with his wife and one last child. The others, I guess, have grown and gone in Meridian, Idaho. Our first respondent will be Mr. Tim Gagelein. He is Vice President of External and Government Relations for Focus on the Family. Formerly, he served as a Special Assistant to President George W. Bush and as Deputy Director of the White House Office of Public Liaison. Oh, back in those days, whenever I would give a talk in Washington, he always showed up. He was my most reliable audience. He was the president's principal outreach contact for conservative and faith-based groups. He also has served as a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, communications director for U.S. Senator Dan Coats of Indiana, one of the few senators who ever really understood family issues, and for Gary Bauer at the Campaign for Working Families. Tim has authored a memoir, The Man in the Middle, Faith and Politics in the George W. Bush Era, and a new book entitled American Restoration. Our second respondent will be Dr. Graham H. Walker. He's executive director of the Independent Institute, assistant editor of the Independent Review, a journal of political economy. He holds his BA in history from Houghton College and a PhD in public law and government from the University of Notre Dame. Dr. Walker has served as associate professor of politics at Catholic University of America, assistant professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, visiting scholar in social science at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, senior research scholar at the Witherspoon Institute, vice president for academic affairs at Oklahoma Wesleyan University, visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and a job many of us would try to avoid, he became the president of a college, Patrick Henry College. He's the author of a number of books, Moral Foundations of Constitutional Thought, and The Ethics of F.A. Hayek, among them. He's a member of the board of directors for the Institute on Religion and Democracy and the C.S. Lewis Society of California. I turn the microphone over now to Professor Yanor.
Well, thank you, Alan, and I want to give a special thanks to Bill McClay for the invitation to come out and speak to the Philadelphia Society here in Dallas. There's a lot of people here whose work I've read and whose work I admire, and I also want to thank you guys for your participation in this event. So the talk that I'm going to give is entitled Upstream from Culture, the Centrality of the Family, which is maybe a little bland, but I'll hope to spice it up a little bit, put some gravy on the potatoes. And I want to start with this question. Can America survive without strong families? Societal decadence is in large part family decadence, the decay of the family. Sure, crime makes decadence. Lack of discipline in the army might mean that there's a decadent society. The quality of a country's leadership might suggest that you have a decadent society. But family decay is the linchpin of society's decay. And sometimes we recognize this, or even are allowed to recognize it. Outward signs of family decadence are rampant. Things like the use of pornography, the easy acceptance of alternative lifestyles, living together outside of marriage, bears, cross-dressing. I'm big, I'm hairy, I'm often mistaken for them. Parents neglecting their children. These are practically what we mean when we talk about family decadence. But then there are other signs of decay that I guess President Hoover's group noticed, but I would say are worse. People are having many fewer babies. Our birth rate has gone from around 2 15 years ago to just over 1.5 today. Trends suggest that about 25% of women born in 1992, today's 30-year-olds, will never have children. In 1990, 2/3 of Americans in the prime of their life were married. Now that number is 50%. People are marrying much later. In the 1990s, when Bob Bork wrote Slouching Toward Gomorrah, which I think is the most gloomy, doomy title that I've ever heard. Of all the gloomy titles, that's the worst. Then, when he wrote that, out-of-wedlock birth rate was around 30% in the country. Now it's 40%. What are we slouching toward now? And this, my friends, is what we call decadence. I'd like to revive that word. Must I go on? Well, let me give you a quick footnote. There's some good news. Decadence has, on some measure, slowed down among those in the higher stratas of the country. But it is accelerating among the lower stratas. That's the bad news. One can see this driving around rural Idaho. One can see this on the mean streets of Chicago. But just a few stats. About 56% of uppers and middles in America in the prime of their life are married, well over half. But it's only 26% among the lower stratas are married. About 50% of the babies in the lower stratas of America are born outside of marriage. Well, that number's about 20% among middle and uppers. We have two Americas. They're divided by marriage formation. But all the numbers are low, and all of them are getting lower. And what is more alarming, perhaps, are political changes that reflect our inability to even talk about this stuff anymore. Family decadence is no longer much of a political football. The parties are not divided on what to do about this decadence because they don't agree on whether it is decadence. None of the recent Democratic Party platforms deal with this problem. Fewer mainstream books are written by liberals on this problem than there were 20 years ago. So the family has become a kind of partisan niche. Republicans have been mouthing mostly the same talking points on this for about two generations, but we'll talk about that in a second. And let's put this into a broader context. Let's think about this in a pretty broad context. Once again, I think this would be a contrast with the Hoover days. Let's put the pornography debate in that broader context. The anti-porn position has lost a lot of ground in three generations. In the late 1950s, the public issue was whether to ban soft core porn literature aimed at adults. My favorite books, like Lady Chatterley's Lover, were banned in New York. And these bans were lifted in the late 50s. We're talking about literature for adults. Then bans on every kind of hardcore porn, went away in the 1970s. Then we got internet pornography. And now it is a partisan issue to ban graphic novels aimed at kindergartners with graphic depictions of oral sex and sodomy. Our libraries in Idaho, for instance, are filled with these books, but our conservative legislators are terrified of the issue. Such actions, taking action against such libraries, are highly controversial, and few are willing to do it. Assume that the ban that was passed in Florida recently holds. Is this a victory? If we consider this a victory, well, what does that say about us? It's very sobering. And it matters. Of course it matters. It matters for social health, and it matters for individual health. This has been the conservative position all along. No society can embrace family decadence and survive. Ill-formed families are associated with all manner of social ill. We are hardly allowed to notice this, but the total breakdown of the urban family has coincided with great crime waves, the lack of school success, gang violence, drug use, poor job prospects, poor habits, poor family formation for the next generation, and a general lack of responsibility. We can notice the same things when they happen in rural America, and we can add suicide to the list of social ills, but we are not allowed to see it as a crisis and to do much about it. Sometimes we deal with the effects of family formation. We will enforce drug laws, for instance, but mostly we just decriminalize drug use so as not to have to deal with those effects. Now, the problems among the upper and middle stratas are less pronounced. We could probably live as a people for a while, at least, if they set the baseline for how Americans lived. This is a way better decadence, I like to say. Our uppers and middles increasingly live like East Asians. Many fewer marriages, many fewer children, but the marriages that there are mostly intact. Think about this. 65% of college-aged women, college-educated women, were married in 1990. That number is 50% in 2017, probably headed to 40% now. And most important, this trend continues. East Asia, with its cratering birth rates and marriage rates, may well be our future. So I'm thinking of another book, Slouching Towards Singapore. What is that? But most importantly, this group will not help revive the family norms anywhere in the rest of society. Family formation now seems to presuppose economic success. And economic success is beyond the reach of lots of people in our society. This is decadence, but without the obvious social pathologies. So our situation is decadence, family decadence, as I say. And the question of what we can do about it is connected with a deeper question of why this is happening. And on this question, I think, conservatives should be taking stock at our great defeats over the last two generations. Consider our family policy victories over the past 30 years. In the beginning, there were tax deductions, and they were good. But America's first tax credit came in the early 90s, $500 per child. Now it sits at $2,000 per child. The marriage penalty has lessened, maybe even closed. Now there are fruitful debates about adopting expanded child support programs. These great accomplishments of conservative policy have nevertheless coincided with sharp declines in fertility and family formation and the great problems among the lower income stratas. Why do we continue to invest hopes in such programs? We should honor those who have done the hard work to get these kinds of programs passed, but let us also fairly acknowledge that these reforms were, ultimately, beside the point. And now let us whisper something quite uncomfortable, but I hope it is clarifying. Family decline reflects a change in America's sexual constitution, in the broad ideas that Americans embrace about what is good, advantageous, and just when it comes to the relations between the sexes. Emphasizing economic support to families was a way where family advocates could support the family without really challenging our new sexual constitution, which is made up of feminist and sexual liberationist principles. Feminists mildly opposed economic support policies, but they could acquiesce in those policies without giving up that much. Those economic policies support the family while mostly accommodating the predominant and very aggressive ideologies of sexual liberation and feminism. And the efficacy of the conservative strategy has been greatly overrated. We should admit it. Can we as a people get from the principles of feminism to strong families? Can we as a people get from the principles of sexual liberation to strong families? If the principles of feminism are the predominant ideology or is among the prominent ideologies of our people, what will families look like? What will families look like if the principles of sexual liberation are our principles? My answer is this. If you want to see what the world of feminism and sexual liberation will look like, look at today's family decline in America and look around the world and then hit the gas pedal. The anti-family nature of feminism and sexual liberation theory are not hidden away in the dark recesses of academic journals. They are sewn into its founding principles. I think it was Irving Berlin asked, if you asked me, I could write a book, and I have written a book on this. But instead of trying to prove what is really beyond dispute, I want to focus on what the success of these ideologies means for those who want to pursue an effective family policy in the future. Let us reflect on conservative failures and on feminist and sexual liberationist successes to plot a roadmap for an effective family policy in the future. let's talk first about the feminist successes. The feminist successes have been the great political success of a high order over the last generations. Feminists have fundamentally transformed public opinion in their direction, such that what we see is different from what we used to see. But the feminist success is not exactly what they had thought it would be. Feminists seek a world beyond gender, in Judith Butler's words. The world has three pillars, I would submit. First, the differences between men and women evaporate, and socialization toward distinct gender roles would be prohibited in a society. Their second goal for feminists is seek a society in which women achieve emotional and economic independence from domestic duties and from family life. In the pursuit of female independence, they adopt the third pillar of feminist thought, which is the end of sexual taboos. Sexual taboos, they say, promote enduring monogamous marriage and enslave women to the family. These three pillars of feminism, independence, androgyny, and the end of sexual taboos, are really sewn into America's political culture now, into its sexual constitution now. But we have not gotten the world that the feminists have promised, not by a long shot. Critics of feminism, and by this I mean conservatives mostly, were right to suggest that all these goals were inhuman and against human nature. All people are dependent, so the aspiration for independence runs against our nature. Men and women are inherently different, so the demand for androgyny is against human nature. Sexual modesty, among other things, is impossible to overcome amongst most people, so that demand is against human nature too. There will always be some sexual taboos. And conservatives have long thought that we have done something when we point out the problems of feminism. Usually we trot out quotations, probably from Horace, to the effect that you can chase nature out with a pitchfork, but she always comes running back in. And we have done something when we show that these theories are insufficient. The problem is we haven't done enough. Conservatives and family activists have been standing athwart the sexual revolution, shouting nature for decades, to little effect. Nature imposes limits, but nature's limits are not self-enforcing, and they do not point directly to family life. Males and females act and think differently from one another under our new sexual constitution, in a rebuke to the androgynous hopes of feminists. A supermajority continues to desire old-fashioned discipline of monogamy and marriage in a rebuke to those who hope to get rid of sexual taboos. But the persistence of nature has not portended a return to norms supporting marriage and family life. Instead, what we get is a new sexual constitution that cultivates a new kind of man and a new kind of woman. And neither the new man or the new woman is much suited to marriage or very willing to prioritize marriage in their lives. And this is the bottom line, right? Feminism and the sexual revolutionaries promised liberation, but there is no liberation. Conservatives have always been right about that. We only get different chains. They have given us new gender scripts instead of no gender scripts. A new idea of what a good woman and a good man is what we've gotten from feminism. We've gotten a new system of honor and shame. They shape public opinion toward their ideal. And it is just that ideal is much less interested in preparing people for marriage and family life. Let me illustrate this with the most obvious and universal example, having babies. Independence from the family is best accomplished if women do never become mothers and never have babies. This may mean that they do not perform the duties of mother, or it may mean that they forego having children altogether. Yet nature screams to women, have babies. Their bodies seem to be made for it. Conservatives may have hoped that the problem would kind of solve itself. How many of us have said this about ourselves and our daughters? Feminism says, do not have kids. The body says, have kids, and nature will win out in the end. But this is obviously not the case. There needs to be public support for the decision to have children. Public honor has to be attached to having children. Nature needs to be encouraged through a welcoming culture. Women can do lots of things in their lives. Why have children instead of trying to make partner in a law firm or teaching gender studies? Why have children instead of becoming a nun? Why take care of the children when a nanny can? Why not farm the job of raising children out to experts like kindergarten teachers and daycare professionals? There's another example of this. It's kind of stunning to have to say it, but I'm going to say it. Sexual attraction is also culturally mediated and can be attenuated in some circumstances. In Japan and South Korea, for instance, we could talk about our hotel for the weekend, but I'll use Japan and South Korea to make this a little more antiseptic. Polls indicate that people have less sex and marriage rates have fallen off the cliff. Birth rates are under one in most of these countries. Manners and mores are needed to encourage men and women to actually dance the sexual dance. We would never have thought that. Sexual attraction seems so natural, but it's also culturally encouraged and discouraged. We used to think that sex provided the grist for love, but both can lessen to almost nothing in society. So the two most basic human so-called instincts are partly constructed by society. In noticing this, we must give a nod to the philosophy undergirding feminism. Feminists thought society constructed nearly everything, and we need to give an inch here. Society constructs things out of the materials provided by nature. Give the feminists more than an inch, however, and they will take the whole mile. So culture finishes nature. Culture shapes nature. Culture uses nature to build as the materials out of which it is built. Nature alone needs the help of culture. This means that family advocates have to get into the business of constructing a sound, family-friendly notion of gender. We must work with the grains of nature to construct sounder and more attractive notions of gender than feminism does. We might call this sex role realism. Perhaps we always knew this, but we've been afraid to say it with our full throats. It is not a question of making time or making sure there are sufficient resources. Those are issues and important issues, but they are second issues. The family policy question is this: how to get people to prioritize enduring relations, deeply communal and serious family life when they have so many other options? What do we want out of women? What do we want out of men? Those have to be our guiding questions, not embarrassed to ask them, but like front and center. And when one answers these questions, one treads obviously on very controversial grounds. Trust me, I know. But we nevertheless must reason together. And this is what I call the sexual counter-revolution. The goals of the sexual counter-revolution are these. We must establish systems of honor and shame, pass laws and buttress institutions that shape the natural inclinations of men and women in more humane and fruitful ways than does this feminist constitution shaped by feminism and the sexual revolutionaries. That is our goal. What do we want from men? Answer: responsibility and provision, sexual self-mastery, and the ability to interest women and provide for them in a family, making demands on children when they are parents, or I should say fathers. What do we want from women? Making motherhood a priority in her life while mixing in work as needed and desired. Honoring an honorable man. Prioritizing nurturing and being the hub of a community. There's nothing more incredible than giving birth to a child. We should say that. And let us see it as a wonder, just as Eve did. Moreover, the closer sex can be brought to the domain of marriage, the better. Perhaps America could begin celebrating big families again as well. This would be very difficult since our leadership class and opinion leaders are people with uncommonly small families. Obviously, motherhood first will not be what every woman does. Obviously, women can do things other than be mothers. But my guess, based on the assessment of the evidence, is that this is the heart's desire. To be a mother is the heart's desire of about 3/4 of American women, and in fact, women around the world. Men would have to mature faster and better to meet their needs. Those norms, however, are needful for a society-wide rebirth of marriage and family life. There are certainly policies that we could adopt to support this vision. We could emphasize part-time work for women. Divorce laws with different default rules might encourage sobering second thoughts, especially from women who file about 70% of divorces. We could embrace sex-segregated education for longer in primary schools. Thorough parental choice in education, not to encourage competition or excellence, but to cultivate and reinforce a sense of parental responsibility, could be adopted. Laws should be based on sex role realism, not the inhumane demands of androgyny from the feminists. When we see disparities in career choices between men and women, we need not panic. They express and reflect sex role realism. For too long, family advocates have accommodated these ideologies or considered them to be unchangeable features of our political community. If they are, we are probably doomed, to quote another doomy, gloomy book. So it is time to liberate our inner Phyllis Schlafly's of blessed memory and oppose feminism again. This means starting small, probably starting with ourselves, but we must ultimately take that ambition national. Thank you.
Scott, thank you, and I can honestly say that the best way to spend a Saturday afternoon is with the likes of Bill McClay and Alan Carlson and Scott Yanor and Graham Walker. And I appreciate very much this honor on behalf of Focus on the Family. I was saying to my great friend Bruce Fronin, we have been coming to the Philadelphia Society since 1985, and that seems galaxies ago. Also, I want to say in the step up to my very brief remarks today, I was honored to go back in the last month and a half and to read 3 books that I think are particularly extraordinary. One is called Coming Apart by Charles Murray. One is Vision of the Anointed by the great Tom Sowell. And Men and Marriage from Dick Gilder. I think too often some of these books are forgotten, and I think in many ways they are underrated. And as Alan was so kind to say, I spent 10 years of my professional life in the United States Senate in dog years. That's about 5,000 years. Nearly 8 years at the White House in dog years. That's 4,000 years. And now I'm in my 15th year at Focus on the Family, all in Washington. And I remember when I came to Focus on the Family, a very dear friend of mine who had headed the Chase Manhattan Bank office in Washington for nearly 35 years said, "Are you thinking of changing the ministry's name to Focus on What's Left of the Family?" And I have never forgotten it. It is still ringing in my ears. In the start of his excellent address to us just now, Scott states something that I think is well worth requoting. Can America survive without strong families? Societal decadence, he said, is in large part about family decadence, the decay of the family. Sure, Scott says, crime marks decadency, as is a lack of society's discipline and the quality of its leadership, but, for emphasis, family decay, he says, is the linchpin of social decay. He later told us, no society can embrace decadence and survive. Ill-informed families, he says, are associated with all manner of social ill. We are hardly allowed to notice that the total breakdown of the urban family has coincided with crime, lack of school success, gang violence, drug use, poor job prospects, poor habits, poor family life in the next generation, and a general lack of responsibility. Scott, I think that says it. I could not agree more with these statements, or another that Scott made in another context several years ago. I went back and read several of your wonderful writings, and I thought this was particularly cogent. Scarcely, you wrote, any area of public policy is unaffected by the decline in marriage and family life. You wrote, Scott, educational attainment of children outside of marriage suffers. The job teachers face is more complicated, and crime is connected with fatherlessness. As the family declines, you wrote, the state rises to take its place. As the state rises to take its place, the family declines further. A very excellent and close friend of many people in the Philadelphia Society is the great Mary Eberstadt. She is now a senior research fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute in Washington. And she echoes this sentiment when she wrote several years ago the following. She said, the new wealth in America, the new wealth is familial wealth, and the new poverty, familial poverty. I think that's worthy of Pat Moynihan. She said, practically every area that plagues our society, rising crime, rampant drug use, gender confusion, failed schools, homelessness, and other economic hardships can be attributed to the decline of the family. Those, she says, in healthy two-parent families thrive. Those who aren't, don't. And Peter Schuck, who is professor emeritus at Yale, he is too little known, by the way, in the area of family studies. A wonderful, powerful book, One Nation Undecided, wrote this. He said, the family is the essential core of any society, and the steady decline of the two-parent household is the issue. He said it's probably the single most consequential social trend of the last half century. Let's not say nothing good comes out of Yale. He goes on to show evidence that regardless of race, children with no father present in the home are almost five times more likely to be poor than children of married couples. This is not an assertion of opinion. This is a fact. He concludes, indeed, the single best predictor, remember, empirically based, the single best predictor of low upward mobility in any given geographic area in the United States is a faction of children with a single parent. Mary Eberstadt, again, along with numerous others, points much of the blame to government dependence. She says it doesn't take a PhD to grasp that the fractured family is the major engine of the increased welfare state. Economists are fond of saying, if you want more of something, we should subsidize it. Amen. For example, let's look, if we may, at what the so-called Great Society, the grand scheme devised in the 1960s by then President Lyndon Johnson and those on the left to supposedly do away, that was their goal, by the way, that's how they sold it to all of America, to do away with poverty in the United States. The Great Society was supposed to eliminate poverty and racial injustice. It included programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, welfare, of course, of various forms, federal education funding to address urban decay, medical care, rural poverty, massive amounts, billions upon billions of federal dollars spent in hopes it would eliminate these problems. And of course, the promise was always from the political class to create more opportunity. But unfortunately, all it created was government dependence, fatherless homes, greater poverty, more despair, and yes, injustice. At the time that the Great Society was implemented, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan was already deeply alarmed about the state of the African-American households that were trapped in what he thought was a seemingly endless cycle of poverty. He wrote that the evidence, not final, but powerfully pervasive, is that the African-American family is crumbling. And now here we are, 60 years later, gathering in Dallas. The African-American family had not only crumbled, it has practically dissolved. At the time Pat Moynihan issued this report on the state of the African-American family, about one quarter of African-American children, one quarter, were living in fatherless homes. Today, more than 70% of all African-American children are born out of wedlock. That is triple the percentage of the problem that the Great Society was purported to solve. By the way, Columbia University does a living history with a number of former people in public life. One of those is Pat Moynihan. And he was asked, after nearly 60 years in public life, what is the number one conclusion that you have observed in this time in the public square? And he said, it is the dissolving of the family, he said, all over the Western world. By the way, when he issued his report in the 1960s, he said that 25% fatherlessness, was a crisis. 25% in 1965 to 70+%. If I may, Mr. Chairman, just briefly share one anecdote. In behalf of Focus on the Family, 3 years ago, I was invited to speak at the Jackie Robinson Center in Pasadena, California. And I was speaking to a room of categorically young African Americans. And it was a room not unlike this, a little over 200 people. And in the middle of my remarks, I said that my father is my best friend. And just like you snap your fingers, almost every young person at that moment sort of winced or looked down. And I came off of the stage and I said to my host, what did I say? The reaction was as if I had said one of George Carlin's seven dirty words. And he said, no. He said, it was a great speech. He said, but you need to remember, Tim, that not one of those young people in that room knows a single person who is married. I'll never forget it. More tragically, four out of every five African-American children raised by a single mother today lives at or below the poverty line in the United States. The situation is dramatically different for married African Americans, of course. The poverty rate for this group is below 10%. Fathers matter. As Manhattan Institute senior fellow Jason Riley writes, the likelihood of teen pregnancy, drug abuse, dropping out of school, and many other social problems grew dramatically when fathers are absent. And the problem now transcends all racial boundaries. In 2014, more than half of Hispanic children were born out of wedlock, as well as one-third of all children born to Caucasian mothers. 50 years ago, only 15% of all American babies were born outside of marriage. The combined rate for all racial groups is now, as we heard a moment ago, a whopping 40%. If marriage rates continue to dip among the middle and lower classes and non-religious, there will still be children born out of wedlock, even if the number of children may be going down. with the associated issues of poverty, social alienation, and identity issues that come with it. Meanwhile, as mentioned earlier, and so eloquently, those children whose parents are married and have raised them with financial and parental security are more likely to succeed, and those who aren't fall further behind with each passing generation. As noted by Robert Rector, the Heritage Foundation, again, a great public intellectual, well-regarded and known by many people in this room, over a decade ago, the result becomes a caste society that only perpetuates the cycle of helplessness and the corresponding dependencies, which has greatly increased with the breakdown of marriage and family among the lower and the middle classes. And thus, the scenario that Mary Eberstadt wrote about, that the new wealth in America is familial wealth, while the new poverty is familial poverty, will continue to increase, and more people will find themselves on the wrong side of that equation. Thus, my hope for a post-pandemic America, and that a focus on the family, is one where every American, regardless of class, sees the value of getting married, having children, and raising those children in a stable, loving home, regardless of material comfort or lack of material comfort. That is a scenario that will bring Americans together rather than further drive us apart. In other words, if we want cultural and personal restoration instead of continued deterioration, we need to reverse course now and incentivize rather than disincentivize marriage. We also need to recognize that the importance of fathers is the central domestic issue of our culture. We are living through a plague of fatherlessness. That is why Scott's call to strengthen rather than weaken marriage and the family is more urgent than ever. It is essential that we have this debate before it is too late. The great George Orwell said that the first duty of an intelligent person is to restate the obvious. And this week, I think, we all should have been horrified. In that hearing, to have a person who will likely be one of our 9 Supreme Court justices, in an almost existential moment, and perhaps in preparation for the Philadelphia Society theme meeting that we're all attending, asked simply 3 words, 4 maybe. What is a woman? Can you imagine what she would have said or how she would have responded if the question would have been, what is a family? What is a marriage? What are parents? This matters. I think if there is a note of hope, it is that as we have seen in the Virginia elections and in various places around our great nation, that we are living in the midst of a parental rebellion, and maybe in that will be a better way forward. Thank you and God bless.
Greetings from your friends at the Independent Institute in Northern California. We're right across the bay from San Francisco, so we get to watch up close and personal the consequences of American progressivism. Now, turning to these papers, or this paper in particular from Scott Yainer, Scott and also Tim together have ably narrated the decline of the family and the disintegration of that institution around which the family coheres, marriage. Moreover, in Scott's telling, it's not that people are indulging in a carnival of sex outside of marriage. Rather, there is both less sex and less marriage going on than there used to be. This wasn't supposed to happen. Under the terms of the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s, the new ethic was that anything goes and nothing is concealed by modesty or restrained by taboo. But instead of sex becoming more glorious, it became more blasé. Aggressive eroticism ultimately weakened the erotic dynamic between men and women. Then, shockingly, it turns out that less sex means fewer babies. And less marriage means that fewer of those babies enjoy the familial context required for their development into well-adjusted adults. In Japan and South Korea, Scott notes, polls indicate that people are having less sex and marriage rates are off the cliff. East Asia, with its cratering birth rates and marriage rates, is our future. As he so aptly puts it, we are slouching towards Singapore. So, what can be done to improve the condition of the family, at least in America? I propose that the Times call for a two-pronged strategy. One, we must fight in the civil sphere for the legal triumph of individual liberty. And two, we must fight in the social sphere for the cultural triumph of natural gender excellence. Let me restate that to be a bit more complete. First prong is this: we must fight in the civil sphere for the legal triumph of individual liberty protections, which can limit the governmentally coercive advance of family corroding moral decay. And second, as we thereby keep at bay the governmental mandate of decay, we must fight in the social sphere for the cultural triumph of natural gender excellence. You could put these things in the negative if you wanted to. Don't fight for the legal triumph of natural mores, and don't fight for the cultural triumph of individual liberty. Both legal and cultural efforts are needed, even if the latter is more fundamental than the former. But since the latter is more fundamental, let me consider these strategies in reverse order right now: culture, then law. Scott is right that various legislative tinkerings supported by conservatives have done nothing to stem the tide undermining sex, marriage, and family. Not child tax credits, not reducing the marriage penalty in the tax code, not expanded child support programs. As Scott puts it, these reforms were ultimately beside the point. That's because these policies did not and could not reach the root of the problem, which lies at the level of mores, habits, and beliefs. As he puts it, family decline reflects a change in America's sexual constitution. Thank you for that phrase. Scott is frighteningly correct when he says that sexual attraction is culturally mandated, that is culturally mediated and can attenuate. Another way to make Scott's point is that the human sexual ecology needs cultivation. The sexual biome, so to speak, is far more fragile than we imagined. It is more like a garden than a wilderness. Moreover, sexual culture change is far more threatening than climate change. We are often hectored that we should care more than we do about the degradation and destruction of habitat. I agree, but I am talking about another kind of habitat whose fate is even more in our power. Scott says this: conservatives and family activists have been standing athwart the sexual revolution shouting nature for decades. You may be among such conservatives, and one could say that your faith in nature's automatic self-correction is touching, but naive. Obviously, much of the confusion on these subjects arises from confusion about the term nature. Modern usage equates natural with automatic, that is, inevitably occurring by physical necessity. In the original Greek-inspired sense of the word, however, what is natural is not what happens automatically by hard wiring. That which is natural for any living thing is that which is consistent with its function, that which fosters its highest potential. Every naturally existing thing has its natural potential, like an acorn is ordered to become an oak, even if they don't all manage it. Man differs in that humans, individually or communally, can voluntarily affect their trajectory toward their potential. And this is especially true in sexual culture. Modern thought has largely forgotten this understanding of what is natural. Yet modern ecologists teach us to identify the overall natural function of each distinct participant in a patterned ecosystem, don't they? So it is with the sexual ecology of the human race. Using the term nature in this original sense, humans are by nature male or female, but their feelings and actions can be out of alignment with their natural function in the order of things. Sexual feelings do not automatically channel themselves into preset default patterns. As with so much of human nature, unruly feelings must be brought into alignment with our naturally given potential. Male and female are naturally ordered to one another and to the procreation and nurture of children. You don't need a Bible to figure that out. It's a natural fact available to anyone. Every human society on record until our day has practiced marriage between man and woman in recognition of this fact. But bringing our feelings into alignment with our nature is not automatic. It is not always achieved in individual instances. Remember the acorn. Yet it must be achieved in the aggregate. Importantly, it is not merely or even primarily an individual undertaking. Like physical ecology, alignment entails interdependence. It is communal, cultural. More than conscious personal self-discipline, our feelings are the consequence of an infant experience, of family structure, of tradition, art, music, and poetry, a million threads which, if properly strung, attach desire to its natural object. These are all the things we are talking about this weekend, and none of these things is governmental. Post-structuralists may call all this social construction, but the older sages would call it nurture in accordance with nature. Or you could call it environmental protection for the human sexual ecology. All of this is just to elaborate what Scott means when he says that, quote, manners and mores are needed to make sure that the sexual dance actually happens. Now, Scott repeatedly says that the culprits are feminism and sexual liberationism. Yes, but I would argue, rather, that the culprit is the whole ensemble of critical or progressive gender theory. To be sure, progressive gender theory is often at odds with itself, just as a metastasizing cancer does not always enhance its own progress. Sometimes this movement celebrates sexual ambiguity, emphasizing the complete fluidity of social constructionism. At other times, it insists that gender identities are natural fixities that persons do not fashion for themselves, but rather discover about themselves, and which cannot be otherwise than they are. I decided I had to be true to who I really am, as people say in this second mode. In other words, sometimes the theory champions sexual free will, and at other times it champions sexual predestination. Advocates of progressive gender theory reconcile their dogmas by insisting that the individual has subjective but absolute investigational sovereignty in the process of discovering his naturally fated identity. This may not be a satisfactory solution, but works in a culture that has never really come to terms with our larger schizophrenia between free will and natural determinism. I say progressive gender theory is the culprit rather than feminism because classic feminism saw itself, at least, as rooted in nature rather than being at odds with nature. Feminists who believe women are allies in the fight for sanity, and many of them are being attacked for dissenting from full-scope progressive gender theory. Progressive gender theory is substantially mistaken. We must not be its enablers. We must foster a healthy culture, and this starts with how we talk about how we write, even among ourselves. For example, if you do not embrace the conceptual apparatus of progressive gender theory, why do you employ its lexicon? You may think of it as merely shorthand, but what are you actually affirming when you say that two people are married when they are merely linked by positive law in a relationship that positive law calls marriage? Why do you describe someone as being a homosexual person as if homosexuality were a natural fixed attribute of his or her personhood? We need to be accurately descriptive without genuflecting to progressive dogma. Sometimes that takes more words. It is not easy, but we must find ways to be courteous without reifying the identity claims of progressive gender theory. This very inadequately concludes my discussion of the second of my two-pronged strategy to fight in the social sphere. I turn now to the first prong. We must fight in the civil sphere for the legal triumph of individual liberty protections against governmentally mandated decay. I'll be a little briefer here. My point is that the times call for us not to attack, but to revive the remnants of liberal justice. To put it differently, we must fan the dying embers of liberal justice into a flame that is still capable of warming us against the cold wind of governmentally coerced decay. We must make the best case we can for limiting government power when it tries to inculcate progressive gender theory. As noted a moment ago, a few days ago, in response to a question from Senator Marsha Blackburn, Ketanji Brown Jackson declined to define what a woman is, saying, "I am not a biologist." Many conservatives ridiculed her for this. It is clear that she was reluctant to say anything contrary to the progressive gender theory upheld by the dominant wing of her party. Still, there is something hopeful in what she said. In a backhanded way, she said that a biologist could tell who is a woman. This is true because biologists know the objective empirical facts of DNA structure. Biologists study genetics, not critical gender theory. Perhaps Judge Brown Jackson answered the way she did, not merely in deference to her progressive backers, but because she is, in fact, deeply grounded in the community that she is deemed to represent, namely the historic African-American community in the United States, where belief in natural sexual identity probably runs stronger than among college-educated whites. In any case, her progressive supporters have to be hoping she didn't mean what she said about biology, because if she did, many of their efforts to use the law to coerce people to accept transgender identity, for example, could be imperiled. Of course, Senator Blackburn was ridiculed by others for her question. But whatever one may think of her style, Senator Blackburn was actually on to something. After all, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits quote-unquote discrimination on account of sex. As a Supreme Court Justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson will almost certainly have to rule on the meaning and application of that provision. Let us hope she meant what she said, both about biology and about taking the wording of statutes as understood by their enactors. Time will tell whether she committed the moral equivalent of perjury on these matters before the Judiciary Committee. I hope not. Let me come at these issues again from a possibly odd, but certainly very current angle. Bear with me. Like some of you, perhaps, I am on the New York Times' mailing list for their daily news summary called The Morning. Last Saturday, it contained this bit. Here's a quote, New York Times. Because Russia's invasion has gone poorly, Chinese officials are likely to be more cautious about sending troops into Taiwan, said Liang Evans Chen at the Institute for National Defense and Security Research in Taiwan. That would be a relief for Taiwan, an island of almost 24 million people with a strong liberal democracy. It is the only Asian government to legally allow same-sex marriages and a modern economy. End of quote. Doesn't it tell you something when the New York Times trots out same-sex marriage as an indicator of a country's being a liberal democracy? How has that become the criterion? It is especially ironic since the Times does not single out gay rights in some generalized form, such as individuals doing what they choose behind closed doors, but focuses specifically on marriage. Such marriage is a governmentally conferred status that obliges other individuals to recognize and act as if they agree with it, regardless of their own convictions. The state coercively mandates the conceptual apparatus of progressive gender theory, and this is the signature of liberal democracy to the New York Times? If I believe the New York Times were right about this, I would be pretty skeptical about liberal democracy. As it is, I know they are simply wrong. But by constant repetition, they and their media peers get people to assume they are right. Some conservatives, especially religious conservatives, fall for the repetition and become hostile to liberal democracy. Make no mistake about it, the legal creation of same-sex marriage carries inescapable coercive consequences. It is not simply about conferring a status on those who desire it. It obliges others to affirm and recognize it as such, or to act as if they affirmed it. And it's not just county clerks and wedding photographers either. By contrast, civil recognition of natural marriage does not violate anyone's individual liberty rights. The issue of conscience on this point is not symmetrical. After all, proponents of progressive doctrine have never claimed that they could not in good conscience affirm that male-female marriage is a really marriage. We are not so far apart as that, thank goodness. They just wanted access to the marriage status for themselves without having to get a partner of the opposite sex. Thus, our individual liberty jurisprudence may have the resources to untangle this knot. At the same time, of course, our equal protection jurisprudence will have to be clarified to make it clear that the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause does not let government coerce citizens to embrace the conceptual apparatus of progressive gender theory. The dispute over marriage law is winnable because many liberals have a guilty conscience about this coercion. The coercion must stop, and they know it. Constitutional litigation on the basis of individual liberty rights could stop it. Our friends over at the Alliance Defending Freedom are doing something about it. In summary, Scott's paper leads me to a two-pronged strategy: fight in the civil sphere for the legal triumph of individual liberty protections, and fight in the social sphere for the cultural triumph of natural gender excellence. Substantive moral culture cannot be advanced through law. To mandate moral belief is to kill it. Ironically, governmentally mandating true moral belief is more damaging than governmentally mandating false moral belief, because it discredits the truth. But legal victories predicated upon robust individual liberty rights can preserve the space in which cultural renewal can be undertaken. Thanks.
We have time for some questions, and I've got a number of them here. They're really some good questions. I'm going to try to combine some of these, and we'll start here with these two. Is the decline of, this is for all members of the panel, we'll start, just kind of start here and go on down. Is the decline of the family related to a decline of masculinity? Question mark. To remedy the decline of the family, are there features of masculinity that must be revived? And I'm going to attach to that another question. A common policy in the mid-20th century was a family wage for fathers and husbands. This was implemented formally and culturally. Could this be a sexual counter-revolution policy?
Does it just go on?
Yep.
Is it working? All right, good.
Yep.
That's kind of magic. So yes, I mean, I think that that there is no way to get to a decent family regime or marriage regime among the lower stratas of American society without supporting the formation of manliness among the lower classes. There is, I would say, a combination of a lack of long-term view of what their lives are going to be like, combined with a decline in economic opportunity that would have to become like the characteristics of working class manliness. And what I would suggest has to be done is, and this, like, very few people are investigating this matter, and this is what Charles Murray's work kind of covers, and he documents the effects of this. But I, you know, to put it very pithily, I think we should work backwards from Archie Bunker and try to revive a kind of working class ethos. Now, I mean that kind of sarcastically, but at least he was married and was responsible enough to have one child and maintained a job. I think it's important to kind of work backwards from a decent working class life. And this is going to involve, I think, reach out efforts from churches, economic opportunities, because I think there can be no revitalization of the family among America's working class without revitalizing the family among America's working class, I should say the desires to establish families among America's working class men. And I think that's actually the most needful thing, and it's the thing that is least able to be talked about because we're aiming policies at, in this particular case, like the least important people in society from our ruling elite's point of view. So I think I would never stop talking about that issue if I were a conservative politician. Actually, these are your voters, and they've been ignored really for decades.
I meant to also just kind of give guidance here. Just try to keep our answers as short as we can so we can, okay. No criticism intended here.
I have a short response.
But just so we get some more questions, make sure we get plenty. Yeah.
Right.
Tim's next.
Oh, well, no, I'm happy to defer.
Oh, okay. All right.
I thank the gentleman from Virginia. just this is in your imagination. In their imagination and fantasy life, what kind of men do feminists find attractive? Just think about that. I think it answers the question about the importance of masculinity.
I'll keep it very short. Yes, no, and yes. Mm-hmm. But I will say anecdotally, Tom Wolfe wrote in the 1970s that there would come a moment where the American novel would be considered outdated because the reality of contemporary life will have become so absurd. I would give $1 million to have had the photo last night coming down to the Philadelphia Society dinner, three of us on one side of the elevator dressed for dinner, three of us on the other side of the elevator, you know, in skirts going to dinner, from two different groups. And I think that this is a sort of a popular cultural snapshot of the absolute need for this national conversation on masculinity and its foundational importance. So, yes.
This is strictly for Scott here. It's a question, first of all, actually two questions. You have addressed the anti-family ideology of feminists that the entire left, not just feminists, has adopted an anti-family ideology. Why single out the ladies here? And second, why so little emphasis on divorce?
Well, I mean, you want me to go on? I could go on and talk about divorce, and I do think that that's a thing, but I actually think it's a subordinate thing to feminism. Look, I mean, here's my simple answer to that. Feminism is among the two or three most powerful opinions governing America's education system and its culture. The image, and I mean this in a technical kind of term of art, of the independent woman is all over our advertising and movies. It's what's emphasized in the education system. Independent of the family is the technical, is the term of art that word means refer to. But you cannot get to strong families from that opinion. Like, there is no way to do it. You can get to weak families, you can get to female-led families, you can get to no families, but you can't get to strong families from that position. And I think the necessity of politics has led to the accommodation of that position, and that is like no longer possible. So that position has to be something that that we aim our fire at, and the social ills that have followed from it, I think, are obvious and well cataloged.
I'll take one question from the floor. And again, we're doing questions. I remember in Philadelphia Society meetings in the past, this is often an opportunity for speeches, but questions.
there is something, I think, that societies used to have that they don't have today, and that's what I'd like you to respond to, and that is, unlike today, societies didn't tell you that you were living for yourself. You were living for something more. You were living for your religion, perhaps, your community, your family, your lineage, your line. Nowadays, we've contracted it all, and it's all about self-realization. Is there any way of getting past that?
Do you have any particular person? Any comments?
Well, it's really hard not to remind ourselves what you reminded us of in passing a moment ago, namely that God had a lot to do with that sense of selflessness and purpose which characterized earlier generations. If our straits are as dire as they seem, we might have to have recourse to a source as potent as we once had.
I do believe we're living in a time of very profound spiritual crisis. And I think that much of what we discussed today is related to the spiritual recession that has, flooded our country. And I think it's not tangential, but I think it's actually foundational, central to many of the questions that we've been talking about. And I think it's, in a very specific way, an answer to the great point that Steve raises.
You know, I had an interesting interview 3 weeks ago now with a noted feminist, Naomi Wolf. It's available on our website. It's really worth watching. She was an advisor to Al Gore and et cetera. She now is saying that our cultural crisis is so great that we need to reconsider God.
Ah. Yeah, he's an important guy. Okay, I have a question here from the audience. If families rather than individuals are to be considered the basic unit of society, should voting then be conducted as family units, not as individuals? Question mark. And let me addend to that an idea that has been kicked around and proposed, that children be given the vote, but that their parents exercise it for them through age 18. What do you think?
Well, I think there's a certain logic to the position. There is a logic to the position. In Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom, he begins with individuals are the basic unit of societies or families. And then he goes on to write Capitalism and Freedom. And as if there's no big implication as to which one it is. And so I think, you know, under the old view, the family is a community and is recognized in law as a community. And that's, I think, the justification for the family having one vote. I don't think as any kind of political strategy in the short term, with marriage being in such bad shape, that any kind of non-individualist or communal policy when it comes to recognizing the family would be workable. But as to what the principles demand, that's another question.
Other comments? Okay.
Who would want to touch that question?
one short comment that relates to the first panel this morning. The legislation that Lyndon Johnson brought in called Aid for Dependent Children has been the greatest enemy of the family that we have done. And then I have a question for all of you, which probably is going to offend people. Have we made, by law, divorce too easy?
Back to the divorce question.
Indeed. I'm thinking of Marianne Glendon's well-known book, 1988, Abortion and Divorce in Western Law. She pointed out that America has the loosest of laws of all advanced countries on both abortion and divorce. And it's a little surprising that we are even more nihilistic than our admired progressive European counterparts. So there's something in that.
Yeah, one of my hobbies is to look back at the actual debates that happened over some of these issues, like the pornography debate in the late 50s. What did each side think would happen if they won? And I've written a paper on the pornography question. No one really anticipated the current way divorce is run when the debates were going on in the early 70s. No one said women were going to file for 70% of the divorces. And they thought it was basically going to be men who filed for the divorces so they could run off with their secretaries. I mean, literally, that was the level of the debate. And so I think the way I would frame the divorce thing is that we've learned in the last 50 plus years some unintended consequences of the divorce regime, and we want to encourage more sober thinking before people undertake divorce. So we're going to change the default rules for who gets possession. Possession isn't the right word, but custody of child, possession of the child, And the custody will go by default to the male. And I think that would be a way of beginning to encourage the kind of thinking that would lead to fewer divorces. But I think the tricky thing here is that you don't want to make it so hard to get divorced that people will just say, I'm going to live together, which is now an option, which wasn't really an option as much when the divorce debate was going on in the early 70s. So I think there is a kind of side door problem that you could have tighter divorce laws actually discourage marriage. And I think that's a real thing.
The only thing you omitted is that the father would then have to take responsibility for the child.
That's true, but I see it as a credible threat. The credible threat is the father will have to take responsibility for the child, and that's what encourages the second thoughts.
I have a question here from the audience, changing subject a little bit. There's a trend in the church, in churches, to downplay the significance of marriage, often in the name of empowering singles or making sure they don't feel bad. Does this perpetuate the decline of marriage? Question.
Yeah, I might pick up on this. At Focus on the Family, we have a 24/7 52 help center. Last year, one of the top 10, and these are very, very big numbers. Last year, I think in the top four or five complaints was people around the country who in an average year in their own parish or church hear not a single sermon or homily or sort of public forum within the church, not a single one on the issue of marriage and divorce. I think that for many of the reasons that we've discussed today, which become controversial among congregants or parishioners, there are, I think, and I think you could prove this empirically, actually, there are a very large percentage of pastors, priests, etc., who simply are wary of discussing these issues for fear of the backlash within their own congregations, unfortunately.
A short question.
Certainly. This question is for Graham. Your second, or one of your two themes was that we should not use government in order to promote traditional gender roles. And
that's right.
I guess my question is that even possible? What I mean by that is certainly no one wants to be heavy-handed. And you were talking about mandates largely, so
yeah,
maybe that's what you...
enforcement and coercion were the terms I was using.
Right. So my question is, there are any number of policies that bear on nudging people towards or away from traditional gender roles, how the tax code is formulated, what mm-hmm. pronouns appear on forms, how
Absolutely.
Easy is it to get a divorce. Surely we should not blind ourselves to which way those will push. Would you disagree or agree with that?
Oh, I totally agree with you, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, there are ways in which state authority can take a position that is not coercive, but nevertheless takes a position. For example, switching to another subject, originally the American solution on religion was that we did not have religious neutrality, but we had religious liberty. That got transmuted in the 60s and 70s into we have to have both religious neutrality and religious liberty. But the original combination was better.
I have been commanded by higher authority to bring this session to an end. So let us thank our speakers and respondents.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Thanks for
really enjoyed this.